Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Journalism, part of the New Books Network. I'm Jenna Spinelli, a journalism instructor at Penn State and host of the Democracy Works podcast. It is my pleasure today to be talking with Andrea Wenzel, assistant professor of journalism, media, and communications at Temple University, and author of Community-Centered Journalism, Engaging People, Exploring Solutions, and Building Trust, which was published in August of 2020 by the University of Illinois Press. Andrea, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
So you start the book talking about your journey from reporter to academic. I think that's a good place to start this conversation as well. Can you talk about your kind of career journey and where engagement journalism entered the picture?
Sure. So I was really lucky in that I had a pretty sweet job in public radio when I first got out of school, and I loved many things about it. But my day-to-day was producing a global affairs program, and the downside was it was terribly depressing to talk about war and disaster every day. And I found that one of the things that gave me a bit of relief, and I thought, well, this might be giving our audience a bit of relief, was when we had stories that were focusing on things that were being done to address problems. This was before we had the language of solutions journalism. But at the time I started a series where every week we'd ask community member or listeners mostly to nominate what they thought of as like a project or a person who was doing something constructive to address a problem in the world. And we did this series every week, and it was hands down our most popular segment. And we had a big reaction to it. We ended up doing like face-to-face expos where we brought people together to talk with different groups and organizations who were doing interesting work around the world. And that got me interested in can this be a way of doing things a little differently? And I got to then experiment some more with that and to integrate more components that I would probably call engagement or engaged journalism now in my work when I ended up doing a number of media projects in different countries, including in Sri Lanka, where we did a project called Fix It, where we would ask people to, this was during the Civil War at the time, and we'd ask people to tell us about what's a problem that you're struggling to address? And we're going to, one of our reporters will go out and try to help you figure out what's going on. And so it might be like a giant pile of trash outside their house that no one collects or something else. And they would just go with them and figure it out. And that again was much more enthusiastically received than some of the other, things that were just looking at the problem. And so that process, and then later on, I had the opportunity to work in Afghanistan with people who had a really sophisticated approach to integrating research into the programming that they did. It was an Afghan NGO that worked with the BBC locally, and they did documentary style reporting, but they also did things like radio soap operas, and they would go around to different villages and talk to people about what are the challenges you're facing, but also how are you, solving your own problems in different ways, and what strategies do you take? And they would find out from people, from their words, and hear how they spoke about it. and they would take that back and then use that to make their programs. It's like, wow, that's so cool. Like, how can we never do anything like this in the US? You know, not that you can apply things, you know, plop them down exactly that way. But through my experience doing all this, like kind of not having words to describe it, but experimenting in different processes like that, when I finally got the chance to go back to school to get my PhD later on, it's like, oh, I want to look into this more. Because, you know, when you're in the doing the day-to-day, you just never have time to really think it through and think about what's working, what's not working, and how can it be, you know, strengthened. And so, you know, once I went back for my PhD, I learned that there's a lot of people smarter than me who've been thinking about this for a long time and had language for it. And at that moment, around the same time, the Solutions Journalism Network was starting up. You know, I learned more about traditions of public journalism and things like peace journalism. And this was still a little bit before words like engaged journalism were thrown around. But that's sort of how I started looking into this as a researcher and trying to kind of connect my experiences back to that.
That's great. And before we dive into some of the specific case studies that you look at in your book, can you just talk a little bit more about what engaged journalism is, to that point of words being thrown around? You know, we hear things like solutions journalism. Some listeners might be familiar with the concept of civic journalism from Jay Rosen. So can you just help orient engaged journalism within this larger ecosystem?
Sure. I mean, I would say engaged journalism definitely connects to civic journalism or public journalism. It's sort of in that same thread and tradition. But it's a word that is notorious for being used to mean everything from like clicks and shares to, you know, really in-depth, intensive, you know, face-to-face engagement. So it can mean so many things. I think I define it, and I'm looking at my notes here because there's so many different ways it can be defined, but I talk about it as a range of practices that try to build relationships between journalists and the public, to assess and respond to their information needs and interests, and to involve the public to varying degrees in the process of journalism. Because I think those are sort of all key areas. And I think it's something that you can think of as it can happen on a spectrum. So there can be, you know, sort of just like things that are more transactional and then things that are more relational and, you know, asks to community members to share an idea for a topic, or it can be actually working with them to develop something. But at its heart, I kind of think about, you know, work that is with and for communities and that is trying to respond to their information needs and involve them in the process.
Yeah, kind of, you know, breaking down that fourth wall, so to speak, you know, putting, there's like this, I don't know, I feel like when I went through journalism school, it's like this armor that you put up to be a good reporter. It's kind of breaking some of that down a little bit, which I think you also talk about in the book. This approach and some of the others you mentioned really challenged what have long been thought of as norms in journalism and in journalism education. Certainly, I think things like objectivity, for example, how does engagement journalism kind of grapple with those longer held tenets of what we've seen journalism as historically?
Yeah, I mean, I think objectivity is at a moment, I feel like we're in a moment right now where there's more and more people having really thoughtful conversations about objectivity, writing books about it. I mean, people have been writing books about it for quite a long time. You know, it's something that can be interpreted in many different ways. I feel like the dominant interpretation of it has been problematic and harmful to a lot of communities, in that it has had a tendency to reinforce existing power dynamics and, you know, the idea of like looking for both sides or two sides of something is tended to end up with overrepresenting people who are in positions of authority, often white men. And encouraging journalists to keep a distance from communities themselves, and from stakeholders within communities who are seen as having, quote, an agenda, you know, as if the people in power that they're talking to don't. So I think it's something that's long been problematic. I think that, you know, the framework that I use of community-centered journalism, which sort of draws on both engaged journalism and solutions journalism, I think would challenge that it's not a helpful norm, and that it creates distance where there doesn't need to be distance, and that doing work that's community centered, you're not necessarily advocating for, say, a political party or a particular group, but you're advocating for the information needs of a community, and that is something that the idea of like being objective and keeping a distance is not helpful.
Yeah, and I think you kind of illustrate some of these points really well in a case study in the book. I believe it was in Los Angeles or that somewhere in California, where they're the media outlet brought together, citizens and reporters and people from community organizations, and they had these kind of dialogues. Can you tell us about that project and how it kind of illustrates? I'm picturing your triangle diagram in the book of communication infrastructure theory and sort of the relationships between those three groups: citizens, community organizations, and reporters or journalists.
Yeah. So, I mean, I draw on this idea, which is, it's a wonky academic theory, but I think it's actually really practical in that it looks at, community. It's based on research that's looked at different kinds of neighborhoods and communities. And it's found that when there's strong relationships between residents, community groups, and local media, there tends to be higher levels of civic participation and a greater like shared sense of understanding of what the community issues are and a sense of belonging. And so in South LA, and at the time I was working with a research group that kind of used this framework, we helped to organize a series of workshops where first we brought together, this was based on, my colleagues having, for years been doing outreach and engagement with different community organizers in this area and kind of having a sense of what the challenges were. And they had long known that there was a lot of distrust between community groups and local media because the community groups were frustrated that the local media kind of only, in their view, came in when something terrible happened or kind of like would call them up and like get a source and then never really like have any accountability to them or the community. And so there wasn't much trust there. And so we organized a series of workshops first with each of them separate. So with community organizers separately and then with journalists separately. And then we connected them. And one of the things we did, which I thought worked surprisingly well, was we did kind of like speed dating with them where we had them basically sort of pitch like their what they did. So like the organizations would share like, here's what we work on. Here's who our constituencies are. The media outlet would share like, here's what we do. Here's the kind of stories that we are generally looking for and how we kind of go about things. And through that process, it was sort of the beginnings of relationships. And from that grew a series of solutions journalism stories that they collaborated on it was tied to the anniversary of the Watts uprisings, like the 50th anniversary. And they did a series looking at different solutions-oriented stories about South Los Angeles. And from that, we circled back with residents to find out how they received those stories and what was it like to hear solutions-oriented stories about your neighborhood, particularly if you're in a neighborhood where you really only hear about your community when something bad happens. And how did that sort of change their relationship with the media and with that kind of storytelling?
Yeah. And that's a super important point about, in certain communities, particularly communities of color. Yeah, the only time that they see reporters or interact with them is when something bad's happening. So that breeds distrust, that breeds a kind of a tuning out, maybe, of just not, why should I pay attention to this when all they do is talk about the bad stuff kind of thing. And that plays itself out over and over and over again in the case studies that you look at in the book. And but it also kind of butts up against this notion that a lot of these projects are very short term. They're like pilots or they're grant funded or they're something, and there's not enough time, it seems, to really break down some of those barriers or kind of go the last mile, maybe. So can you, I guess, talk a little bit about how these news organizations are thinking about that piece of it, and maybe, you know, what can all of us do if we agree that this is a good model and a good concept to move forward? What can, you know, we all as people who think about and study journalism do to help kind of move some of these things forward?
It's a really important and kind of gigantic question. I mean, it's so much of this work comes down to sustainability, both in terms of resources and money, but also time. And it's, you know, we can't assume that like just making a good thing is going to lead to it making money, or, you know, so it's a huge problem. All or almost all of the projects that I looked at in this book had some degree of, you know, philanthropic support, they almost all were grant funded. Not all, but mostly. And, you know, it's hard to answer the sustainability question in an easy way. I think we can hopefully, many of us agree that there's probably not a market solution for much of this kind of work, and that the business model is broken, and, you know, advertising revenue and things like that are not going to be the way to deal with it. I mean, as with most of journalism, I think that there's ways of weaving in this sort of approach to doing community-centered journalism into all the work of journalism, and just sort of making it normal journalism. I hope, and I think some organizations are, you know, closer to that idea than others, and are, you know, accepting that. But no matter what, even if it's just sort of seen as part of the normal work, it is something that requires resources and requires time. And this I think is very similar to any initiatives around inclusive journalism as well, like initiatives, diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives, I think have similar challenges, in that you're asking people to sort of do their work in a way that can take more time. And so our resources are not infinite, and especially for local journalism, which is already so stretched and stressed, and to be like, oh, here, can you do this other thing, and I don't have more money for you. it's really a painful ask, and I recognize that. But I think that it's something that if people are concerned about building trust with their communities, is worth exploring, like, how, you know, how could we make this happen in some way? Maybe it's not, you know, an incredibly intensive project, but are there other ways of sort of integrating elements of it? And I should also add that some of the projects I looked at are not necessarily projects that, you know, are reliant upon just a news organization. You know, there's a role here for other kinds of community stakeholders and or new projects that maybe aren't a traditional news outlet. That doesn't solve the problem of needing resources, but that's just to kind of add on that it's not, you know, there's other actors that could potentially be involved, including, you know, other kinds of organizations that I think we could be open to imagining having a role in journalism that we traditionally haven't. So like libraries or community organizations, or, you know, looking at different variations of what we used to call citizen journalism. So, I mean, I think there's other ways of kind of exploring this, none of which completely solve the problem of resource needs. But I think, you know, it's a tricky thing.
Right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon,
shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. As you said, a big question and one that we're certainly not going to fully answer in the course of this conversation. But, you know, I've been thinking a lot about Chicago. That seems to be kind of a hotbed for a lot of this activity. And as a way to kind of bring this down to a more sort of on the ground level, I've been thinking about your example in the book from WBEZ. I believe it was called the Curious City Project. And so that's, to my mind, like engaged journalism at a traditional or like legacy media organization. But then there's also City Bureau, for example, and perhaps other sort of newer media organizations that are explicitly, you know, community focused in some way. And so can you kind of compare and contrast what the engagement or community journalism looks like at you know, legacy organization versus something that's maybe newer and more directly engagement focused?
Sure. So I think that Chicago is a really great place to kind of consider. Yes, I think Chicago and Philadelphia, they're just kind of both spoiled for good examples. But WBEZ, Chicago, the public radio station, their Curious City Project, I think it's evolved a lot over time and continued to evolve past the moment where I was writing about in this book. But, you know, it started out as, you know, looking for ways to basically crowdsource ideas for stories and then to some degree involve the people who asked questions that they wanted reporters to answer in the process of doing the reporting. This is using the Parkin platform, which people may be familiar with that a number of different newsrooms use. You know, you might use it and not even know it. You go to a website and it says, you know, what questions do you have about your city? Or, you know, it might be framed in a much more nuanced way than that. But anyhow, so it's something that they realized that they were just hearing from the same old people. They were not hearing very much from majority Black and Brown neighborhoods of the city. And so they wanted to understand how they could do a better job at that. They did a sort of an experiment where they did try different outreach methods. And what ended up being the most effective was kind of a really basic approach of collaborating with libraries to set up tables and just, you know, meet people who were going to the library anyhow and get them to ask questions. It really expanded who they heard from, and that kind of helped to shape the agenda of the news stories they were reporting through that process. But even that had limitations. And I think part of it was, you know, part of it kind of comes from being in a more traditional newsroom where there's like distinctions historically between like what they think of as marketing and like thinking of it, of some things, the lines between engagement and marketing being muddled. So, or being like something that they were not quite, didn't have their heads around. So for example, like they wanted to, if they wanted to sort of circle back and share, you know, do events with community members, like there are different people who did that. Mm-hmm. And, there are some basic things that they could have done that they didn't do at the time. Like just have a flyer to tell people how to hear the program and like how to follow up. And so there's different ways that that they, you know, could have kind of done more to create a feedback loop with the community members. And since then, they have done a lot of things to try to improve that. But I think that there's like sort of a curve in the ability to adapt when you're in a larger organization that might have norms about how it interacts with communities. And, you know, they also had like the constraints of objectivity norms that were like very much an effect of like a skepticism of working with community organizations and not wanting to be sort of tied up with the agendas of community organizations. And I think that's something that can be a real barrier to doing this sort of work and is something that's worth questioning. You know, when you talk about a group like City Bureau, it's completely free of so much of that baggage. And there's so many things that like connect them and make them, you know, these are two organizations that I think do a lot of things right and that do a lot of really great work. But City Bureau, you know, it's set up with like its core mission being looking at, you know, equity and representation and engagement. And it's like, that's so much baked into it that it's not like it has to undo stuff. For the most part, they're able to kind of start fresh. And there's a lot that's freeing in that. I think it's really great when you can have it be a both and situation where you have both of these kinds of groups working in the same space, so they can kind of push each other and you can reach different groups of people. City Bureau through projects like Documenters and all of their work, are doing really pretty groundbreaking things in terms of reimagining who does the work that we traditionally associate with journalism and reimagining like what are the priorities of journalism. I think like pretty much most, they've gotten a lot of attention and a lot of support and funding. But I think it's all been very well deserved. I think people can resent the sort of golden children of this space, but I think like I have nothing but props for them.
No, totally. They're doing really, really great work. So we've talked about kind of big cities so far, Chicago and Los Angeles, but this is not exclusively a concept in urban areas. I know you also look at an example from a rural community. Talk about how this model is similar or perhaps different in a non-urban area.
Sure. I guess like all the case studies I look at, one thing that ties them together is that they're all communities that in some way or another have been marginalized in some way. And so I think it's kind of an obvious case in many communities of color in different cities, but also a number of rural communities have historically been stigmatized in national media in particular, but also just, in various ways, when you look at the kind of regional context as well. And so one of the projects I looked at was in a rural area in Western Kentucky, where there was we did a process of looking at what are the information needs of the community, and then inviting people to come together to brainstorm what they saw as possible interventions to meet those needs and to respond to them. And out of that grew a few projects, and one of them was a project working with a local online outlet called the Ohio County Monitor that served a really pretty geographically big county and it was these two brothers doing it who were, they're the owners, the editors, the photographers, everything. And they had to cover this really big county with just them and very little in the way of budget. one of the things that we did that I think I argue throughout this book that like I don't think there's one answer for all local journalism. There's not something that can be like scaled in different places, but you can look at a process. And so by looking at what are people's needs, but also looking at what are the assets that are already there, in this case, we were able to look at, okay, there's like traditions in this community already. So for example, they have something called society columnists that they used to always have. And so some newspapers still have this sort of pre-Facebook idea of, someone sends an update from their part of the county, so-and-so had a baby, so-and-so had a guest from out of town. It's kind of a lot of the stuff that we think of maybe just coming on social media now. But they were like, how can we kind of rethink that tradition and make it into a community contributors project where we could use it as a way to hear from parts of the county that we're probably not going to hear from otherwise, and also responding to some of the problems and concerns people had about feeling like their narratives weren't being represented. And so they did that, and they got a number of people to write monthly columns, they're different kinds of stories, like really widely varying in the topics and the approaches. But that was a really interesting way to kind of invite community members to kind of take ownership They also did something they called Liar's Tables Tours, where they would drive around to different convenience stores in the areas where if you would go in the morning, you'd find a table of, you know, old timers sitting around having coffee and solving the world's problems, in their words. And these were like spaces, and Liar's Tables is their term, not mine. But these are spaces where, like, that's how you find out what's going on in that part of the county. And so they wanted to connect their readership, which aren't necessarily connected to these, to know like what's going on by dropping in on them and having a sort of listening tour to find out what issues were. And so those are just kind of a couple of small interventions that they tried to do to connect more and build relationships with their audience and their community. And I think that sort of process of like looking at needs and assets can kind of help different kinds of outlets come to those spaces.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really appreciated about all the different cases you looked at. I think you're right that there's something that no matter where you live, what type of community you're in, there's like a little piece or a little like nugget of something you could potentially pull out, whether it's to put into practice or to teach or to, yeah, use in class, what have you. So, you know, this book was obviously written before the pandemic. I'm wondering what some of this work looks like now, if you've had follow-ups with any of the organizations you worked with, how they've adapted their practices to the kind of reality we've been in for the past year or so.
Yeah, I mean, it was so kind of gut-wrenching for the, I mean, there's so many reasons everything is gut-wrenching, but it's like to see people who've been doing this sort of face-to-face work and having face-to-face be so much part of it, like trying to grapple with how do we do this when we can't be face-to-face. But people have been doing it. And I think basically, you know, a lot of the strategies that people doing this sort of work employ are basically using community organizing strategies and adapting them for journalists. And so one of the projects that I'm still connected to here in Philadelphia is called the Germantown Info Hub. And they were able to pivot to online outreach and engagement, not without a hitch. You know, it was tough, but they did, and we worked with them, and another researcher worked with them to do like a kind of updated information needs assessment by doing online focus groups and then using that to kind of inform like, okay, what are the things people need? And so they were able to do things like an online resource guide and also like print out copies and just like collaborate with the few spaces that were actually giving things out, giving out food baskets and things like that. They would put the resource guides in that. They were able to kind of find ways of meeting people's information needs and just like connection needs in that new context. They also did things like one of the things that grew out of the focus groups we did was people were saying, you know, we know there's a lot of groups doing different kinds of service provision for the pandemic, but we're not all connected to each other. And so there's just a sense that we're missing things and different groups didn't know about each other and there might be repetition. And so we had like a virtual town hall to help those groups connect with each other. And so we kind of tried to the information hub would provide a convening role of connecting different community organizations to help them connect to each other. So that was another thing that they did to try to respond to the moment. They continued to do, they also shifted to doing collaborating with the community radio station so they could have that be another way of reaching different people that weren't maybe necessarily connecting to them otherwise. I think that they did a pretty good, I mean, or continue to do a valiant job trying to figure out how to take these community organizing strategies and shift them and recognizing the people they're going to miss and how to like think about, okay, who's not online, who doesn't have access, how can we connect with them through the phone or how can we collaborate with different community organizations that have a network, who have a phone tree or who have, you know, whatever processes that make the most sense for that part of the community to try to see how they could, you know, keep people from completely falling through the cracks as much as possible.
Right. And now I'm sure the conversation is turning to, okay, what of those strategies we've developed over the past year are going to stick with us as we, you know, mm-hmm. are able to integrate face-to-face events and activities back into our work and our overall planning.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that that's a conversation that's still kind of ongoing in terms of, in many ways there's been opportunities as much as it's been this, awful, to connect with some people who might come to an online thing, but not a face-to-face thing. and so I think that they'll probably be trying to think about how they can do combinations of, different kinds of hybrid things or having some things online. I think they've done some projects like they've done a number of community narrative projects where they try to work with people to do some storytelling that they've used online platforms. And I think they're trying to think of now how they do some face-to-face outdoor variations of that in combination to the online things. So I think it's still kind of a messy moment of thinking that through. But I think that there's definitely elements that are going to stick with it. I think there's been a number of collaborations being built that are connections between groups that hopefully will continue on.
Right. So you end the book kind of questioning or wondering about what a new type of journalist might look like what skills are necessary for this work that, as we've talked about, might not have been necessary or viewed as relevant in previous eras of the profession. So how should journalism educators be thinking about this moving forward?
That's a really important question that I'm thinking as a journalism educator, thinking about a lot. I think that there's a number of skills that we haven't traditionally done a great job at. I mean, nobody has really done a great job at imparting to journalism students. So for example, I think, there's things like facilitation skills or thinking about community organizing skills for journalists, things that haven't traditionally been part of our curriculum that I think would be really great to weave in more. And there are some educators who have been doing modules around on facilitation or, thinking about different elements of engagement. I think that's great. We need to learn from what's already been started. But I think that, there's sort of two sides of it. One side is, looking at how to take apart the things that don't work or that are potentially problematic. I mean, things like addressing objectivity norms and addressing the potential harms that can come from some ways that those are interpreted. But then also thinking about what are the capacities and the skill sets that journalists need or journalists interested in this kind of work in particular need. And I hope that it's not just seen as a niche pursuit, and that's something I feel strongly about, not just in journalism education, but in newsrooms, where I don't think this should be the work of one person with engagement in their title. I think it's something that person gets siloed off and never, that's something I hear over and over again as a struggle from many people. So I hope that gets challenged in the newsroom, but also within journalism education, that this is something that could be, taken as a module into any journalism class and doesn't just sit within a sort of specialized element of journalism, because there certainly are specialized skills and some people might really want to dig into those deeply, but there's other things that I think can be, taken into any sort of reporting approach.
Yeah, it's funny. As you were saying that, I was thinking, this, maybe people could make this a special seminar or something that they offer. But I think your approach is perhaps better, more spot on, that this really should be something that's part of the entire curriculum top to bottom, not just something students can choose to take or not.
I mean, it could be a both and, I think because there are probably not everybody's going to be a total whiz at facilitation or, there's certain things that it might not be everybody's jam or it might not be, realistic to begin with to make that everybody's thing. But I think that, I think in an ideal world, it would be integrated into everything, but also if people really wanted to specialize, they could.
Yeah. So, you know, hopefully listeners, if they are interested in learning more, we'll pick up your book and check it out. But are there other resources you would recommend that folks check out if they want to learn more about this field and where they might fit within it?
Sure. I mean, there's so many. I would say, like, you know, I've mentioned community organizing. Like, I think Free Press News Voices has a lot of great online resource guides looking at how journalists can adapt community organizing strategies. So does the Listening Post Collective. They have a lot of great online toolkits and playbooks and things like that. Obviously, we've mentioned a number of organizations like City Bureau. Resolve Philly also has a lot of great things. But yeah, there's a lot of really dynamic work happening in this space right now. There's also other academic books. Jacob Nelson has a new book that looks at some, it kind of points out some of the challenges of doing this work. And there's others as well, but that's maybe a starting point.
Yeah, I'll be interviewing Jacob for the show hopefully soon, so listeners can stay tuned for that. It'll be kind of two sides to this conversation. Last question, Andrea, before we let you go here. What else are you working on right now? Is there a follow-up to this project, or do you see it continuing in some way?
Yeah, I guess I'm looking at some things that are sort of follow-up. And one of the things I'm looking at are questions around, you know, if we are questioning things like objectivity, what comes in its place, and thinking about things like what are guiding values for journalism, what could a process of figuring those out be look like, and both at the newsroom level and then kind of the field level. I'm looking at a number of case examples that try to address grapple with structural racism within their newsrooms and the industry more broadly. But kind of looking at questions around inclusive journalism and initiatives that try to make journalism a little bit more inclusive overall. That's kind of I'm at the muddy, not very good at explaining it yet phase in my research, but yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, well, that sounds like very, very important work. And so thank you for all of your efforts on that and for this book as well. Just to remind listeners again, it's called Community-Centered Journalism, Engaging People, Exploring Solutions, and Building Trust. And you can find it from the University of Illinois Press or wherever you get your books. So, Andrea, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.